Yeah, hello, Fosnum. So authenticated encryption in storage system is the thing I want to talk about. I don't know if any one of you knows what authenticated encryption is. Just a quick shorthand. So I think everyone here knows what ASXTS is. That's probably like the most common storage cipher. You know, when you use Decrypt, per default, it uses ASXTS. But, you know, from maybe some government regulation, you might heard that, you know, the usage of authenticated encryption or something like AED ciphers like ASGCM is recommended, right? Like when you use something like server-side encryption in S3, for example, ASGCM is used by default, and that's just an example of an authenticated AED cipher authenticated encryption in the system. And what essentially happens, what is the engineering challenge behind it? Why isn't everyone using it? That's essentially because we have like something called the ciphertext expansion. So when you encrypt, let's say, 4 kilobytes of data with ASXTS, you know, the decrypt standard, then your 4K input, 4K output, or 4KB output, right? But with using authenticated encryption, we get an additional authentication tag. So you can think of it as something like an HMAC or like hash, right? So when you encrypt your 4 kilobyte something, then you get 4 kilobyte and let's say 32 bytes authentication tag. And when you decrypt it, you need to supply this specific authentication tag with that corresponding data to be able to decrypt it. If you don't have that, if you know this 32 bytes gets lost on the way, then you have no way to recover your data. That's how these algorithms are designed. And the main reason why you want to use them, or why, you know, some compliance people say why you should use them, is because in ASXTS, there's no kind of checking if the ciphertext is actually valid, right? Like if I have a ciphertext that's encrypted something, I don't know, I flip a bit, I decrypt it, and ASXTS gives me the guarantee that the output will be garbage. You know, it will just be some random, seemingly random byte stream, right? And then kind of the system that's consuming that decrypted garbage has to somehow deal with it. And at best case, it will throw an error and be like, oh yeah, I don't know, out of format or something. But it's not really deterministic behavior, right? And with AAD encryption, you know, if you try to decrypt and the data, the ciphertext has somehow been modified, then it will throw an error. That's essentially it. And the engineering challenge is storing this extra bytes. So in S3, in object storage, we have this problem is kind of solved. In file system encryption, like let's say standard tools like FScript, they don't use it at all. Or as I mentioned before, Decrypt also doesn't support it by default. There might be some user space tools that use it, but as I said, like the big, let's say kernel space encryption solutions, they don't really employ it, except in the Linux kernel, or I think also in FreeBSD, there are ways to use it, but it's always a little bit cumbersome. For example, in the Linux kernel, you can use something called decrypt with DM integrity to use it. But if you use it in a cloud environment, you essentially use your thin provisioning and resizing capabilities because it expects a set formatting that you cannot change afterwards for some reason. I think that's an implementation limitation that can be overcome, but it has yet been to overcome. So if anyone's interested in that kind of topic, how to make storage more secure, that's maybe a thing that you could look into. So I'm really looking forward into the second talk, and yeah, that's been my lightning talk.
Oh, yeah. Under time, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Perfect. Hopefully it isn't.
No, not at all. One could say too little. All right, Ellen? Perfect. Do you have any slides or something?
Yeah, I do. I just put a Google Drive link. Hopefully that.
Yeah. Okay. I guess. Yeah. Right. Sorry, my button is very sticky for some reason.
I think it's actually in the. I just edited.
I see.
Yeah.
Nope, that's the wrong one. Okay. Here we are.
At the bottom.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Hopefully. It seems to be working,
it's okay.
So okay.
All right.
Let me zoom this in a bit.
Yeah.
Perfect. Hopefully, that works. Okay, so hey everyone, I just wanted to give everyone a preview of what I've been working on for the last while. Oh, this doesn't quite show the whole thing on here, but I call this Hawknet. I think it's cropped to the side, the presentation
that's
is.
My but. Bad. That's an issue with, what do we have here? Ta-ta-ta.
I've seen XR&R a lot of times today, so.
Yeah, right? Okay. We want probably, who does run this?
Oh, sorry.
Go set this one.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. Okay. So this is something I've been working on for a while, but haven't previewed it yet. So I call it Hawknet. And the basic idea behind this is you install it on any device in an organization or group, and the device contributes storage to a shared pool. Maybe you've heard this before in distributed storage. And the key difference here is you interact with your files just like Dropbox or Google Drive, and there's end-to-end encryption, which is two things that are not really taken as design considerations in a lot of other systems like this. So just to give you an example of what that looks like, we have a web server that you can use, like Dropbox if you want to download the files, but also, crucially, the OS integration. So we use the Apple File Provider API, which is sort of very in-depth integrated with the operating system. It materializes files with APFS thin copies without sort of you needing to think about what is on the device versus not. And of course, being distributed, it's very high speed as well, so you can quickly download things. So this is an Android version of this integration and an iOS version. And I'm going to be working on an FA notify hook for extension to Linux, which I'll get into a bit later. So the overall vision is you upload your data in one place on one device, download it somewhere else, and you can just access it in your Finder and whatever Explorer you use, depending on your operating system, just like Dropbox. It's very, very convenient. And also programmatic access, which not currently S3 compatible, but something like that eventually. And so the redundancy design for this, it's chunked Reed Solomon with streamed uploads and downloads. And if you ever used Reed Solomon, you know that it's kind of difficult. You need to get all, if you lose the original fragments, you need to get at least the size of the file to recover things. So we split it up into chunks. The max chunk size is 40 megabytes, and inside each chunk, then split into 10 fragments, 10 original fragments and 20 recovery fragments. So that's 4 megabytes max per fragment, if you're doing the math there, and then distribute them with each fragment index I placed in the same node for all chunks 0 to n. So that means that you get the same redundancy characteristics as you would with full file Reed Solomon, which guarantees, you know, a 1 in 3 if you have a 3 node network failure, a maximum of 20 failures with this number of fragments hard-coded. And so that enables streaming file access even if original file fragments are lost. And this is really important when you're using things like the file provider API, because it does provide like a POSIX compatible API there, where if you go in a terminal and you type like cat, a really big file, it will just start to output it and it will just keep dumping to the terminal as it downloads from the other devices in the network. So you get super high speed performance. If you've got like a 70 gig video in there, you can just start playing it back immediately. And yeah, you only need that first chunk to stream the file. So even if you lose some of the original fragments, you just incur a maximum 40 megabytes time to first byte out of the system. And it also scales quite nicely, these hard-coded number of fragments. Free node network, 1 in 3 to survive. 20 nodes max failure is probably okay with that hard-coded 20 recovery fragments, even in a large network. With regards to how this all works synchronization-wise, it's got a two-phase Byzantine fault-tolerant consensus state machine. So it's a derivative of Hotstuff 2, if you're familiar with distributed systems there. But it has a dynamic Byzantine fault-tolerance approach. So, of course, the startup problem is really complex in BFT systems, where if you only have less than, say, 7 nodes, which is the requirement for, like, 2n plus 1 recovery, you need to get that many nodes, which doesn't work very well with consumer hardware. This allows us to fall back to majority rules if we have less than 7 nodes, and then you get those BFT safety guarantees above 7 nodes. And it also has a dynamic validator set. The nodes will automatically vote out and vote back in nodes that go offline. So if you have roaming hardware like laptops, really good for that. Of course, there are a lot of security considerations there with regards to, you know, DDoS and that kind of thing, which is something that is still being worked on there. And per node state, the consensus is decoupled from file operations. So basically, if you upload a new file or a modification to a file, the hash gets propagated to, you know, through this consensus system before the fragments actually finish the distribution. So that happens asynchronously from the actual state machine progression. So that's good for highly concurrent uses. If I update a file and someone else hasn't yet sort of seen or fetched the fragments of that change, they know immediately that the change has happened, and their device, when they double-click it, will, you know, make the call or, you know, send calls to other nodes' APIs to fetch the fragments from them to reconstruct the file, rather than them working with an outdated file. Each node maintains a DuckDB representation of the global file system state, and the consensus is basically just tracking transactions against that database. And so with regards to the encryption security architecture, file paths are encrypted with AES-SIV, which gives us deterministic encryption. So at each level, you can basically use like a find where in this encryption level if you want to find all the files in a path without having to do, you know, really slow tree traversal sort of things to find what is in this path. And that key also is just tied to the user's ED25519 identity. So you just roam with this one thing. I've been very interested in web crypto, have rolled out some ED25519 sort of support recently. So, you know, that has some interesting things for like web architecture of decryption. Can I keep going? No?
That's the rule.
Okay.
5 minutes. Maybe
sounds
you
good.
Should propose a talk next year.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Thank you.
All right. We have Joe. Do we have Joe?
Can I turn my computer?
Of course, of course.
All right. So, does anyone here has heard about Solid?
Can you?
No. No, yeah, Solid, everybody. Sorry. Oh, yes.
Can you grab the microphone?
Oh, yes, sure. Okay. Yeah, there is a lot of name for, so now it's my turn to do some X-Render magic. I have a script for that normally. Probably won't work. Oh, well. Okay. Yes, so I'm going to present Solid as fast as I can. So basically, Solid stands for Social Linked Data, and it's a project initiated by Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the web, where, like, I built this web for, like, utopia of shared, decentralized shared knowledge, and why it becomes this dystopian of capitalism of surveillance. And he's like a bit sad of what his invention has become, like Frankenstein a little bit. So he was like, how can we solve it at a design level? What went wrong in the architecture of the web? And his idea is that when you use the web, a web app, it's always the application who stores the data. And this is what went wrong, because it allows the app to capitalize on data. And this is the new goal today, right? And the most richest company are based on user data. So he's like, maybe we should allow the user to store the data where they want, and to have those apps that we can call like zero data apps that just like fetch the data, do whatever they want, and then put it back where the user wants. So that's the idea. It's based on W3C standard, and it's just like an extension of web standard. It's an extension of a web standard like HTTP. It's based on linked data. So basically, linked data, it's a way of storing data in triples, where you every item is a full URL, and you define relation between data. So for example, if you have an art piece called Mona Lisa, you give it, this is your subject, you give it a predicate, which is like the artist, so who created this the art. And then the object is like Leonardo da Vinci, and it allow you to create this massive graph of knowledge, and it's really cool it's a really cool way to store data, and it also allow to have interoperability, which is essential in the Solid project. So the goal is to give every user a pod, which is a personal online data store, and you see it as a third-party database that every user has and can connect to application. And the application will store the user data in a pod in a linked data format. Why in a linked data format? Because this allow wow, I went a little bit high energy. it allow so for example, if you like in a solid world, if you want to switch from Gmail to ProtonMail, and assuming like all user has a pod, you just remove access from Gmail to your mail folder and your contact folder, and you allow ProtonMail to have access to your pods, to your pod mail and contact folder. So this is really cool because you just handle, and then on Proton you have all your contact, all your mail, you have all your data exactly the same because they are stored in the same place, and also because they are stored in linked data, which allows this interoperability. Okay, we don't care about this. Yeah, so how does it look? That's the workflow. So on the left we have an app that doesn't store any data, and on the right we have a solid server which both has the database, the user database, and the identity provider. You ask the user to sign in, it gets redirected to the identity provider of the solid server, the user identify, and then the app has all the permission it needs to fetch the data. So now we assume that in the user pod there is some task, and it will know with some standard it will know where to find the task, and it will return it in the app. And I think I just built this last minute, so this is a presentation for something else. I think I'm done with my point. If I have a few minutes remaining, I don't know what to talk about.
30 seconds,
yeah, all right. Well, thank you for for listening, and if you are excited about this as much as I am, because it's really cool as a web developer to program with Solid, because basically the user comes with a full, it's like an abstraction of a backend, you can see it, right? So you just have to build a front-end app, and you imagine that the user already have authentication and data storage. So as a web developer, I think it's super excited to have a web where we can have that. And all right, thank you for listening.
Hello. I'm glad you could hear me. So this is based on a talk that I have given a couple of times before. Hopefully this works out. Hello, my name is Gwen Dawes. I work for the University of Cambridge, and I do Lustre. Lustre is... Oh crikey. Let me grab my laptop. No. Let's hope this works. That should work, maybe. Is that going to work? I don't know. Let's see, shall we? It certainly, maybe I need to do the thing. Oh, that's annoying. That is terrible. Okay, that's encouraging. Yeah. Excellent. Oh, come on. Come on. Full screen. Can you do it? Go on. Stupid laptop. No. Oh, bloody thing. I hate this machine. It is. I need to get it on a solid surface, otherwise the mouse doesn't work properly. Come on. Come on. You're on time now.
What if you... Yeah,
that's what I was going to say. If I can get it to... No, if I full screen it, it doesn't work.
You're probably going to lose. Put 0-0 on that screen, otherwise it thinks it's still on the other... So the top left corner...
What are you talking about?
Try the top left corner of the window needs to be on the external screen.
Oh, I see, yes, like so.
Otherwise it
gets unhappy.
On the main.
Like so.
Because I use Xmonad for a reason, because then you don't have to deal with this kind of
stuff. Yeah, tell me about it. Oh, this is so awful. I really hate this machine. I'm hoping I can successfully manage to get a replacement soon.
Otherwise you can press the Windows button, the Shift button, and then left or right. Windows, Shift, left or right.
Nice try. Oh, this is annoying. Let's see if I can get that to work again. How annoying.
1 minute left.
I do indeed have 1 minute left. That is so irritating.
No,
I really
science, just read them to us.
I need to get a replacement laptop.
Please read it to us.
Yes, of course.
So,
fine. So, hello. Hello, I do Lustre. Lustre is also software-defined storage, but Lustre is built quite differently. It has very little in the way of software-defined resilience. It primarily works on having all of that resilience put onto its hardware level, which is great if you want really serious performance. I have some really serious performance numbers. Can't show them to you because I can't get the slides to work because of my laptop. Isn't that great? I'm part of, I've been administering Dawn, which is one of the UK's supercomputers. We've been working on the big Lustre file system for it so we can provide storage to AI workloads. AI workloads need lots of performance and very low latency and basically as much as you can throw at it. How do we do this? Well, we use a large quantity of NVMEs to be able to provide the actual base storage layer, but of course most NVMEs that are bought these days have no resilience at all, so a combination of software that doesn't provide any resilience and hardware that doesn't provide any resilience is kind of a bad time. So we've put some extra software on top of it to be able to provide that storage in a way that is able to deal with the blast radius of users to make sure that it's suitably sort of handled to them. So we use Slurm because I'm HPC, so Slurm is our scheduler. And as a scheduler, that means we can control where our users put their data, and we make sure that the usage of our data relates to how much they can lose. So we have a carefully crafted construction to make sure that it's actually capable of handling the lack of resilience, and that is something that we can translate to our users. It's kind of difficult because everyone sees a POSIX file system and thinks that every POSIX file system is going to act the same way, and they don't. They very much do not, which is kind of fun and really difficult to describe to users. But does it go fast? Yes, it goes fast if you treat it the right way around. The fundamental problem is where am I? It's in my slides. If you run through the page cache, we actually find we're only at about 20% of the performance. So we have potentially 100 gigabytes per second RW on these machines, and that's per node. If we don't use ODirect and we use the page cache, we only get about 20. But we can get it to about 85 gigabytes per second if we turn off the page cache and use ODirect instead. And it turns out that in Lustre 2.16, there's a thing called Hybrid I.O. that does that automatically for you, so you don't even have to get the users to understand what ODirect even means. Isn't that nice? So, in a nutshell, without my slides, that's pretty much the subject at hand. Isn't that nice?
All right. Anybody else interested in coming up here for 5 minutes? I guess not. Well, then, thanks, everybody. Hope to see you next year.